So only humans have credit cards. So humans have to build a relationship with you if they want to pay you. They get to know you, like you, trust you, understand you, and then they buy stuff from you. So the more people you have relationships with, the more people buy stuff from you.
How can we shift as creatives from this idea or this world where we're so focused on ourselves and our work to serving other people?
In the creative space, there are so many people who are talented creatives and they're talented at doing the work, and there's so few people who are happy selling it. The person who's got the upper hand is actually the person who knows how to sell creative work.
And so if I'm one of those people that is very good at my craft, but either hate sales or just feel like I'm not very good at it, what are some of my options? In today's episode of the Creative Courage podcast, I am joined by none other than Daniel Priestley. If you're not familiar with Daniel, he is an entrepreneur, a best-selling author, and started his first company at the age of 21, which turned into a multi-million dollar enterprise by the time he was 25. He's since gone on to grow businesses in the UK, the USA, Singapore, and Australia, and also been an advisor to a portfolio of ventures. So he's a pretty impressive guy. And you might have seen him recently on podcasts like The Diary of a CEO. He's been on podcasts with Ali Abdaal. So we're lucky to have Daniel on today's podcast. And we talk about everything from creativity to entrepreneurship, how to do work in your creative flow, in your zone of genius, and just cover some really fun, really interesting topics. So if you're currently running a creative business, there is no better person to listen to. If you enjoyed this podcast, as always, please hit the subscribe button and share it with a friend. Daniel, you have written and published 6 books, many of which have been bestsellers. How do you maintain that level of creative output?
It's funny that I look back over the last 10 years, I have that same question because I was also having 3 babies at the same time. So there was a lot of that decade was a lot of books and a lot of babies.
Yeah, books and babies. That was the theme.
Yeah, exactly. How do I maintain that level of creative output? It's in the diary. I block it out. With the published books where you get a big publisher that gives you an advance and then they give you a deadline, and if you don't submit your draft by that deadline, there's all sorts of penalties. That kind of works.
That's motivation, yeah.
That's motivation. With the book 24 Assets, I was just really pumped to get it out. I really wanted it to just be out, and I just kept pushing to write. I think the first book, I was a bit nervous to get a book done, and like sort of it was a little bit tricky not knowing the process. But then once I knew the process, it's just a piece of work. It's just getting something out of your head, chipping away at it, knowing that the benefits are there. I think too, seeing the benefits and knowing the benefits of having a book is a big part of it.
For people that haven't ever written a book, what are some of the benefits of writing a book?
It's relationships on steroids. Basically, when you build lots of relationships with people, good things happen. So if you start with that as a simple idea, the good things happen off the back of relationships. Even if you're just purely about the money, only humans have credit cards, right? So dogs don't have any credit cards. Other computers don't have credit cards. So only humans have credit cards. So humans have to build a relationship with you if they want to pay you. They get to know you, like you, trust you, understand you, and then they buy stuff from you. So the more people you have relationships with, the more people buy stuff from you, the more people support your business and all of that sort of stuff. So back in the early days of my business career, I used to build relationships by hosting little events and having people for coffee and having meetings and all that sort of stuff. And there was a few times where people who were authors either sent me a book or they turned up to a meeting and they gave me a book, and I built a relationship with people whose books that I read. I remember, like, for example, reading, you know, Malcolm Gladwell or Seth Godin and thinking, wow, I really respect these people, even though they have no idea who I am. I have respect for them. So I got it in my head. Okay, if I have a book out, I'm going to end up having, you know, a relationship with a lot more people. I'm going to have a lot of people who get to know my ideas and want to do something with me. So yeah, basically, I got the book out, I gave away thousands of copies, and suddenly good stuff started happening, all sorts of good stuff. So I just have this feeling that if you want to kind of like build a relationship with just thousands and thousands of people, a book is just a really good way to do that. And then as if by magic, great stuff happened.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's interesting these two things at play, because when you think about the creative process of writing, it's very different to the process of relationship building. And so one of the things that I find with our clients is that they really struggle with that relationship piece. It almost feels like a grind to them, because it's almost a means to an end of getting clients. If it was up to them, they would just be doing the creative work, and, you know, clients are the evil necessity. I'm just wondering, what advice do you have for those people?
Write a book.
Yeah.
Because then you don't have to meet any clients. People read the book and they fall in love with your ideas and want to work with you. It massively reduces the amount of time you have to spend with other humans. Yeah. So if you're a massive introvert, writing a book is quite a good idea.
Does this translate to other content mediums? If the idea of writing a book just seems crazy to me as somebody who's a graphic designer, is there any other way to build those kind of relationships at scale, or is like a book the only way?
Yeah, no, a podcast can do that. Being a speaker on a stage can do that. Video content can do that. Really good articles can do that. So there is some research that says that people need to spend either 11 interactions or 7 hours consuming content in order for them to really get to know you, like you, and trust you. And it's either you're going to do that in an analog way, where you have to meet, do lots of meetings. And if ever you've sold to corporate, you already know what this is like. You know, you have an initial meeting, and then you have another meeting, and you have another meeting, and 3, 4, 5 meetings later, and then they kind of like get 7 or 8 people in on the meetings. And they're just kind of building up the amount that they know, like, and trust you. And then finally they sign a deal with you. So you have to, you know, that's essentially doing it in an analog way. And many people can relate to, you know, having to go through that with a particular client who just seems like perpetually on the fence, that they're not quite sure if they should go ahead. And it's like, oh, how many times do I have to go over this stuff? But that's humans. That's how humans work. That's how humans tick. So if you can scale this through, you know, content creation, you know, happy days. But the benefit of a book is it takes all your good ideas and puts it in one neat little place, puts a value on it. And it's funny, it actually occupies actual real estate in people's office. So the thing with the digital asset, like a video or a podcast, is that people are great while they're consuming it, but then it's gone, it's disappeared. But the lovely thing about a book is it actually is physically around someone for quite a while.
Yeah. What would be the first step if I'm listening to this and I go, okay, maybe I should consider writing a book, but it feels a little bit intimidating, or I don't really know where to start. Where do I start?
Sales meetings. So you have lots of really good sales meetings. And when you do sales, you find yourself telling certain stories and sharing certain ideas. And those ideas and those stories enroll people and they get them excited and then they want to buy stuff. So the goal of, like, if you want to write a really good book, do a bunch of sales meetings and pay attention to the stories and the ideas and the methods and the insights that you end up talking about and presenting during a sales meeting, and see if you can stick all of that into a book in a way that kind of just shares those key ideas with people. You know, I'm not a believer in, like, writing a book that's a textbook and telling people how to do what you do. That's not a good book. A good book is a book that sells people on an idea. It actually gets them to adopt a new way of thinking.
Yeah. And I find you a fascinating person for a few reasons, but one of them is your ability to merge between these two things. When I say these two things, what I mean is creativity and relationship building / sales. Because I know that there's going to be people listening to this that go, I just got so excited. I thought I found a way that I'd never have to go and have sales conversations with people. And then your answer to writing a good book is have sales conversations, right? So thinking through the lens of creativity, and I know you've got a portfolio of creative agencies, so you can kind of relate to this. Is there any way to escape sales, or is it just one of those things that I have to suck up as a creative business owner and just do?
You can get a co-founder or a salesperson who does all that for you, but you have to pay them the lion's share of the money. So the value in anything is going to move heavily towards the person who can make the sale. It's an unfortunate reality, but ultimately in anything, there's someone who has the leverage and someone who doesn't have the leverage, right? So in any relationship, someone's got leverage and someone hasn't got leverage. So there's, like, a hard thing that's hard to replace and an easy thing that's easy to replace. And on most businesses, the hard thing is sales and generating demand. So if we basically break down a business and say that a business is a balance of demand and supply tension, that ultimately a business has a supply of something and then it has relative demand to that supply. So it doesn't really matter what it is. Let's say you're a creative agency, you've got 10 people working there. You have the ability to supply a certain number of services each year. So that's the supply side. And then you're a very successful agency if more people want that than you can possibly look after. So let's say, theoretically, let's say you have 1,000 units of supply and 10,000 people want to buy 10,000 units. That's what we call a very successful agency. You're in demand, right? People are missing out. People are fighting. They're clamoring for access. And an unsuccessful agency would be an agency that has 1,000 units of supply, but only can sell 200 units of those. It's losing money and it's unpopular and, you know, people are sitting around twiddling their thumbs. So ultimately, the value of any business at the moment, in most cases, goes to the demand side. In most cases. So ultimately, there are huge numbers of people who are very, very talented when it comes to their creativity, but they're not very good at selling their creativity. So therefore, the supply side is saturated and the demand side is difficult. So like, for example, I know someone who has a film production agency and they just put an ad in the job on a jobs board looking for someone to be a it was either a producer or it was a editor or maybe a camera person. But anyway, they posted some jobs and about 400 people applied for each job. So if we look at the leverage side of things, the leverage is that if you're really talented at that particular craft, at being able to supply that skill, there's 399 other people who also are saying that they're just as talented as you are and they're flooding in. Now, if you look at what makes that particular agency, I know that agency well. If you look at what makes that agency successful, it's that the founder of that agency is extremely good at winning business. They're really, really good at working with corporates to go and access big budgets and win the work. And essentially, if that person stops, then everything stops. So the person who's got the leverage is the one in 400 people who has the ability to win the work, not the 400 people who know how to deliver the work. It sucks. It is what it is, right? And it's not like that in every industry. I've got a friend of mine who's a dentist, and this dentist can charge out at $2,500 a day. Any dental studio will pay $2,500 a day to this guy to do this particular type of dentistry. There's a waiting list for this type of dentistry. He's completely in demand. He doesn't have to win any business. The business is just sitting there in waiting lists. Every dental studio has got a waiting list for this particular type of work. And all he has to do is show up and get $2,500 for the day. Now, happy days, that's great. But he's got the leverage. He can work as little or as much as he likes. And he's found himself in a position of having leverage. But you've got to figure out in your industry, where's the leverage? Is the leverage on winning the business or is the leverage on delivering the business?
For people that aren't familiar with that term, what does leverage mean or what do you mean by leverage?
Well, a simple way of saying it, who's got the upper hand? What's harder to replace?
And in the creative space, that's sales, right?
In the creative space, there are so many people who are talented creatives and they're talented at doing the work, and there's so few people who are happy selling it and they don't like selling it. So the person who's got the upper hand is actually the person who knows how to sell creative work, and the people who know how to deliver it, unfortunately, are in hot supply.
And so if I'm one of those people that is very good at my craft, but either hate sales or just feel like I'm not very good at it, what are some of my options?
So sales is really just something that can be trained and learned. So you can get good at sales. Sales can be massively supported by digital assets or other assets, like having a book, winning awards, podcasts, videos, talks, online content. All of that can support the sales process and do some of the heavy lifting in the sales process. Sales is largely a mindset. People have a negative mindset towards sales. They don't realize that sales is a very high-end thing to do. The brands that have the most salespeople are luxury brands. The brands that have the most investment in sales is luxury brands. So, you know, selling is a luxury, high-end professional thing to do. So you could change your mindset towards sales, or you can just accept it. You can just accept that what you like to do is something that doesn't have the leverage of, you know, that relies upon the leverage of sales. Therefore, you just simply pay the lion's share to the salesperson or to the co-founder who's good at sales. And look, there are plenty of people who do that. There are plenty of musicians who realize that they have to play for free because, you know, if you don't have the ability to draw in the audience or draw the crowd, if you love playing music, sometimes you play for free. There are plenty of posts on social media, viral posts that are like, hey, you're not paying me for the hour, you're paying me for the 10 years of learning how to do it and all this sort of stuff. All of that's nonsense. You know, people get paid their market rate. It's demand and supply. You're paid a market rate. You're paid whatever the market is willing to pay you. And it's not at all fair. No one cares. It's not fair. If I can get someone to do this for free and they're just as good as you are and they're willing to do it for free, I'll take free. And that's just how it is.
Yeah. One of the things I love about having been mentored by you is your view and your attachment to reality. And I remember once there was a post that I put in the Facebook group about how hard it was. And there was a bunch of people saying sort of like, oh, it's okay, Matt, you'll get through this. And I think you replied just being like, entrepreneurship is hard. Get used to it. Like the market doesn't care. It took me a while to sort of digest it. And there were people being like, damn, that's so harsh, blah, blah, blah. But it was so useful because it was such a grounding in reality that allowed me to actually detach myself and my value from the market and what the market wants. Mm. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because I know a lot of creatives really struggle with this. They come to us and say, I want to get paid what I'm worth. I feel like I'm undervaluing myself. I know you've kind of got some thoughts around this.
Well, for starters, we're not worth anything. Like this idea that we're worth something is I think pretty ridiculous. Everything comes down to market forces. Why should someone in Africa be worth less than someone in the USA? That's not like fundamentally as humans, we're all worth the same thing. We're all fundamentally have a worth and it should be considered to be the same, equal worth. What we're paid is market forces. Now, if we were to say, I want to get paid what I'm worth, just look around. Footballers earn more than nurses, but nurses save people's lives. And footballers just kick a ball around. That's silly. You know, there's plenty of examples like that are just silly examples. But as soon as you kind of say, hey, look, this whole game of like being worth something is so stupid, it's just market forces. So once you realize that it's just market forces, then you realize, well, to a degree, I'm in control of market forces. To a degree, I can control how many people know about me, how many people like me, how many people trust me, how many people understand my value proposition. So those things are all in control, you know, in my control to a degree. I can also do things like have sales meetings where I'm able to clearly articulate my value as it relates to that particular individual or that particular business. And I'm able to overcome objections that they might have or blind spots that they might have. So those are the things where you start saying, hey, this is not about fairness. It's not about worth. Markets are very unfair places. You know, there's no reason why a diamond should be worth what it's worth. There's no reason why a diamond should be worth more than a cup of water. You know, a cup of water keeps you alive. Diamond is pretty ridiculous, but it's just demand and supply tension. It's just market forces.
I think the positive side of this is from what I'm hearing, these are all skills that can be learned.
Yeah, strategies, skills, tactics. It's a game and you need to learn to play the game. And part of that game is understanding the reality of the game and not sitting there saying it shouldn't be this way. Okay, it shouldn't be this way. I agree with you. Now what? Like,
yeah, it's very disempowering to have that belief system, right? Because it's out of your control. It's all the economy and this and that and everything else. And it's like, okay, where do we go from here?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, let's sit around and wait until utopia arrives. Let's sit around and wait until like the winds of change blow and suddenly branding consultants are worth more than doctors. Like, okay. I'm always a big believer, and I say this to my kids as well. I say, if life was suddenly fair, you'd probably be in a much worse off situation. Like if suddenly the world became a fairer place, you'd probably suffer. Because there's like if we were to take all the names of every individual who's ever lived and put them all into a hat and say that you have to put reach back into that hat and redraw and swap places with whoever's name you pull out, there's a really solid chance that you'd be worse off. So like given that you're already in an unfair advantage, you know, then let's not complain about fairness. Let's get on with actually just winning the game.
Yeah, I love that. This is a little bit of a side quest, if you like. But that just reminds me of something that you said to me once. And I don't know if you remember this, but I was asking you about stress. And I was saying, how do you handle stress? How do you deal with things when everything feels like it's going wrong in your various companies that you have. And you had a very kind of specific thing that you told me. You said, this might sound a bit stupid, but do you remember that? Or remember what it is?
I'm not sure. I don't actually know. The truth is I don't remember what I said.
Okay. What you said was you go outside and you stand in your garden and you look up at the sun and you feel the sun on your skin and you imagine how long it took for those light particles and the earth and basically like really zoom out and just kind of put everything into perspective. And and that's something that I've kind of heard you do a lot and talk about a lot, which is this idea that actually we live in one of the most affluent, abundant times. We live in one of the best times to start a business. Have you got any other ways or beliefs maybe that you use to frame things when it feels like nothing's going your way?
Reframing is a really great place. So reframing is like zooming out and seeing the world from space and having a look down at Earth from space and sort of like seeing that my world, my little ecosystem is very tiny compared to the size of the Earth or from the sun. The sun is 1.3 million times bigger than the Earth. So it's like, okay, you know, and then zoom out in time and say, of the last 10,000 years of human civilization, which other time would I have had it easier? At what time was it fairer? At what time was it better? You know, I saw this guy on Twitter the other day talking about how children born to rich families have got an unfair advantage compared to children born in poorer families. And he was like making a big deal of this. And it's like, okay, what other time in history has that not been true? Like, that's always been true. So, okay, get on with it. Like, what do you want to do? You want to kill the firstborn of every rich family? Like, what's your plan? Of course, they've got an unfair advantage. So yeah, zooming out is a great reframe and sort of just making a list of all the things I'm grateful for. So, you know, focusing on the few things that aren't going well, you could say, actually, let me make a list of all the things that are going well. So for example, do I have arthritis? No. Do I have plenty of time ahead? Yes. Am I dealing with like an abusive partner or friend or bully? No. Okay. So there's actually plenty of stuff that's going well. You could always make a list of things that you're quite happy that you've got going on or not going on. That's all about reframing. Then there's like setting new rules and saying, okay, what are my rules for success? Maybe I've set some unrealistic rules. Maybe that I've sort of set a time frame that's not the right time frame. Yeah, I spoke to a young guy who was really stressed the other day. And this, in particular, this young guy is very, very, very successful and he's in his 20s. I said to him, if you were a top 1% earner and you kept your entire 1% income for 40 years in a row, you'd have about 6.6 million pounds, right? Career earnings of a 1%er is about 6 million over 40 years adjusted for inflation. I said, you've already made 6 million, 6.6 million. You've already done it. I said, you've already achieved a 1% income for an entire 40 years worth of career. I said, you've already won the game. You're playing with house money. And he was like, oh, why am I stressed? I'm like, yeah, exactly. Like you've already won the game. You've already achieved so much. But it's funny because the human brain plays these tricks on us where we think, you know, just because of our human instincts, we think this is working or not working. We don't take into consideration that of all of human history, you've already won the lottery. Like every single person of the last 10,000 years or 99% of people of the last 10,000 years would probably trade places with you just for access to Google.
Yeah. I love that. Yeah. And like when we were skiing the other week, you kept saying like, what a great time to be alive. Like how lucky are we? And kind of looking around at this thing, which was skiing and it's amazing, right? I just wonder, have you always had that view of the world or is this something that you kind of had to practice or do practice regularly?
I can remember having this for a long time. I really am quite stoked to just be born in a first world country. Like I really am. That's like my rule for success. It's like, damn, I'm so lucky. I'm so lucky to be born at this particular moment in time. And yeah, like skiing. At what other time in history could you sit on a chair and it takes you to the top of a mountain and then you fly down it on a you know polycarbonate board that's strapped to your feet with like perfectly molded plastic? It's like, this is wild. Like imagine trying to explain this to most humans.
Where did you get that frame from? Do you remember? Like, was it from your parents? Was it from school? Was it from mentors?
There was definitely a switch that happened in my head when I was in India and I spent a day in a slum and there was no water around, right? There was these water charities that were dumping barrels of water. And I remember that night going to the hotel and jumping in the shower and turning on the shower and just like almost breaking down in tears or did break down in tears just at this reality that I can turn on this tap and there are people just 15 minutes away who require aid agencies to dump barrels of water in their local area or else they'll dehydrate and die. And here I am, turn it on. And I had this realization that my whole life, all this stuff is happening around me on the off chance I might want it. So I kind of had this thought of like, I remember thinking it through and going, damn, like there are bakers and bakeries that bake bread on the off chance that I might buy it. Right now, there's a petrol station 2 minutes down the road on the off chance that I might want petrol. It's got it there for me. You know, if I might want chewing gum, they're just they're buying bundles of chewing gum just in case Daniel Priestley wants to go in and buy some chewing gum. There are airplanes that are just like sitting on the runway on the off chance I might want to fly somewhere. So like it kind of blew my mind. I remember having that thought of like, damn, like all this stuff is just there. Like it's just available and it's there on the off chance that I want it and I have access to it. And a lot of people don't. Like a lot of people don't. There's plenty of people who don't have it. I had a few experiences like that. I was in Uganda once, in rural Uganda, with this organization that I was part of that we were raising funds for. And I remember sitting in this orphanage, outdoor orphanage, and these kids are trying to like write. And there's one kid's got a pen and the pen casing had like gotten down to 2 centimeters. And there's like the ink part poking out the top and the pen casing just there. And trying to write the alphabet with this shitty little pen. And I realize that I have a hotel pen in my pocket. And I go, I'm going to give the kid the pen. So I pull the pen out of my pocket and I go to give it to the kid. And the woman I was with, Kathy, she grabs my hand and she pushes the pen back to my pocket. God, that's really weird. And she just kind of like gestures for me to just watch what's going on. And I'm watching this kid struggling to just write. And I'm getting emotional and I'm thinking, God, you know, just the simple basics of having access to a pen, something that I take for granted so much. And then afterwards, I was in the car and I said to Kathy, you know, Kathy, how come you didn't let me give the kid the pen? And she says, you don't get to come here and feel like a hero for the cost of a hotel pen. I'm like, damn, okay. She's like, I want you to feel the pain of and the helplessness so that you remember this moment and you go home and do something big about it. I don't want you to just give the pen and relieve the tension. She was really good at sales. Yeah, she got me a beauty. But, you know, stuff like that really did hit me. And like just ever since then, like I just even just look at pens differently. Just think, you know, God, I've got access to just all these pens. And there's people, I genuinely have spent time with people who don't have access to a pen.
So two questions are coming up for me. The first one is, what do you think the relationship between success and gratitude is?
I think they're strongly linked because gratitude is the process of spotting value. It's the process of spotting something that's an opportunity, spotting something of value. So when you're grateful for pens, you spot the value of the pen. When you're grateful for Facebook ads, the ability to run Facebook ads, you start putting a value on that and you seize it. People who are lacking gratitude, they think that they're downtrodden and they're having a hard time and they think that, you know, oh, it's not fair and all this sort of stuff. Not very productive in those moments. They're not really spotting what's going on around them. They're not seeing the full opportunity. So, you know, they're zoomed in on a problem and they're feeling, you know, a victim to their circumstances. And then as a result, they're not getting on top of it and they're not spotting the opportunity. They're the rat inside the maze as opposed to the person looking down and seeing the whole maze and seeing the way out. Going back to your story about how you posted on the group and you're like, oh, you know, this is really hard. The longer you stay reinforced in that space, the longer you stay in that space. And the longer and the faster you get to the point of going, actually, entrepreneurship is hard, but it's not as hard as digging a road and it's not bricklaying. It's not, you know, it's not as hard as living in a slum. You know, then you go, oh, okay, yeah, I'm being a booba. I need to crack on.
Yeah, you shake yourself out of it, right?
Yeah, and you go, wait a sec, what am I talking about? I'm talking about just returning a few phone calls. Like, come on, have a glass of harden the fuck up and get on with it.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a concept that you talk about, which I don't think gets enough credit, which is the kind of three parts of our brain, the empire builder, the reptile, and
the autopilot.
The autopilot. Yeah. Can you just talk a little bit more about those three and how it relates to what we're currently talking about?
Yeah, so I noticed about myself that I swing or that I was, I still swing between three mindsets. So I noticed that there is the reptile Daniel, there's the autopilot Daniel, and then there's the visionary Daniel. So the reptile Daniel is fight, flight, freeze, freak out, throw tantrums, get angry, get frustrated, poor me, I'm the victim. And it's just very ego-driven and emotional and all of that sort of stuff. And then autopilot is just like repeating what works and just doing things I've done before. And, you know, for example, you can kind of like drive and be on the phone and you can go for a walk and kind of like not have to think about the path if you've walked that path many times. You know, you can easily kind of just walk into a store and just, you know, kind of pay for something and walk out with it and all that sort of stuff. So you're just like on autopilot, very low level of thinking. And then there's these visionary moments and these moments of like thinking about how you might innovate something or thinking about how a business might be set up differently or thinking about a massive problem that millions of people face and that there might be a solution to that. And in that visionary mode, the idea of raising a few million to launch something doesn't feel big, doesn't feel scary. The idea of hiring 100 people doesn't feel big or scary. The idea of partnering with a large brand in order to roll something out just feels like a normal thing to do. And you just kind of like, I noticed about myself that there was this kind of mode that I could get myself into, which was kind of like, why not? You know, why not talk to this company? Why not put together this dinner party? Why not roll this product out? Why not try and develop this software? It's like a pretty fearless place, a kind of like, hey, this is not a big deal. Let's try it, see what happens. And it's like, I don't need, in that visionary space, it's like, I don't need to know the details of how it's going to work. I'm sure we'll figure it out along the way. Whereas like the reptile's like, I don't know, I've never done that before. And what if it fails? And, you know, all that sort of stuff. And it's not fair that I just don't have rich parents. I just wish I had rich parents. You know, then I wouldn't have to worry about all this sort of thing. So I kind of noticed that those three things swing. And then I remember just thinking, I wonder if I can try and minimize the amount of time spent in reptile and maximize the amount of time spent in visionary. Like, are there things that I can do to do that? And I found a few little hacks, and it's like gratitude journaling is a hack, reframing and setting new rules, having rest is a hack, being just aware about it, like literally writing down, I'm in reptile mode, and then waiting 5, 6, 7 minutes. Sometimes it's like, I'm not in the right mood. I'm not in the right zone. I need to go have a shower or something, freshen up, flick the switch, get back. I noticed that hanging around with like certain people would immediately put me in visionary. And there were other people that would kind of like drag me down. There were certain activities that were very autopilot activities. Like, it's very easy to spend an hour scrolling on social media and kind of just getting into autopilot. So it's like, try and avoid those activities or set an alarm, something like that. Essentially what I found is that there's really no downside to being in visionary mode a lot. Like, it's not like you actually, it doesn't drain you. It's not like you sit there and have a certain limited amount of visionary mode per day that you can do and then you're exhausted. It's the opposite. You actually feel quite energized if you've spent the day in visionary mode. Obviously, you need to rest and you need to sleep, but you can have these incredible streaks or runs where you're like thinking big all the time and getting big things done all the time, and it doesn't wear you out. I think actually reptile mode probably wears you out fastest. It's exhausting being upset all the time.
So the first thing is just basically be aware of those three things, and that we're essentially always trying to get into visionary as much as possible. And then the second thing is having some tools up your sleeve when you do find yourself in either reptile or autopilot to snap yourself out of them.
Yeah. And just sometimes just the awareness is such a powerful thing. Like, just being aware that, just knowing I don't make good decisions when I'm in reptile mode. Don't pick up the phone. Don't send that email. You know, just wait. Wait until tomorrow.
And is there anything else you do? Because obviously we live in this society now that is constantly talking about breath work and ice baths and things like that. You don't strike me particularly as somebody who's bought into that way of thinking. Is it for you as simple as those tools, or is there anything else that you do?
Anything that is sort of like overly narcissistic, where you're really thinking heavily about you and your experience and your needs and all this sort of stuff. To a degree, it's, you know, obviously there's a productive element to it, but to a degree it's counterproductive, because all success is about the value that you deliver for others. Pretty much everything comes down to what you're doing for other people of value. And everything else is just noise. You know, like I know people who go full monk mode and they're like, you know, I'm just like not drinking and not having dinner and not, you know, fasting and I'm, you know, I'm doing ice baths and all this sort of stuff. And it's like, okay, that's great. But that impacts you. And really, you're not doing anything for anyone else. So, like, don't be surprised when no one wants to pay you or interact with you. And then I know people who are, they're out and doing stuff and they're drinking and going out late, but they're actually delivering value for others and plenty of people want to interact with them, plenty of people want to pay them. So ultimately, my skepticism with all that stuff is that if it genuinely charges your batteries in service of delivering value to others, and that's what you're doing it for, and that's why you need to do it. Okay, if that's what you need to do in order to deliver value for others, great. But the vast majority of people I see doing that stuff, it's not. They're just sniffing their own farts. They're really just sitting around contemplating their navel. And like, no, it doesn't add any value to anyone else. And then they wonder why they're not successful.
Mm, that was such a big shift for me. I remember some of the exercises that I did working with you and your team were really about understanding the person that you want to help to a degree that I'd never really understood before. And I'd very much, from a creative perspective, come from this background or this way of thinking that if my work was good enough, then by default, people would just want to buy it or interact with me. How can we shift as creatives from this idea or this world where we're so focused on ourselves and our work to serving other people? Like, where do we start with that?
I think the starting point is reality, which is just that people only pay for something that strikes them as valuable. It was a tricky situation with my 9-year-old. My 9-year-old was talking to me about selling hot chocolate out the front of the house. And we did that. We had a hot chocolate sale and people who walked past bought hot chocolates and all that sort of stuff. And then he wanted to draw pictures of trains and he wanted to sell those out the front of the house. And no one wanted to buy those. And I had to explain that, like, a lot of people, what they want is a hot chocolate on a cold day, but very few people are thinking, I want a train that someone's drawn. And, you know, he had to come to terms with the fact that it really, if you want to get money off someone, you have to give them the thing that they want. So to a degree, it's like there's a grown-up version of that, which is, you know, John Lennon released an album of him just wailing, screaming, doing emotional release work, and it didn't sell as well as the pop music. It turns out people like listening to pop as opposed to emotional release work. So, you know, we got to tune into the marketplace. Obviously, it's a dance. You know, you got to find something you enjoy doing. You got to find something that you want to deliver as well. But it's probably not the extreme end. There's going to have to be a compromise somewhere, an overlap of what you want to do and what the market wants.
So this idea of just being able to do work for me kind of is fine, but just don't expect anything in return. Like, if something happens, great, but you can't have any expectation around it, basically.
Yeah, well, if you're doing it for you, you're the customer, aren't you? You're the one who's effectively buying your time. That's great. You know, if you're incredibly lucky, there's a massive overlap between what you love to do and what the market wants. If you're unlucky, there's no overlap at all. You just have to have hobbies on the weekend and work. You know, and mind you, for most of human history, that was the norm, right? Go back to my grandfather. He worked in a factory manufacturing copper cable. He was working most of the time around plastics and copper and, you know, heavy machinery and very loud, noisy machinery. And, you know, there's kind of like toxic chemicals around and smell of it, sparks flying occasionally and all that sort of stuff. Not a particularly nice place to work. But on the weekend, he had fishing and golfing, and those were his fun activities that he really enjoyed doing. But he thought that was the most normal thing in the world, that work was something you get paid to do because it's not fun, and hobbies are things that you get to do because you are, it is fun, but no one pays you to do them. In fact, you have to pay to do them. So, you know, he understood that there was a clear delineation. There was very little overlap between what he could get paid for and what he enjoyed doing. But he thought that was normal. We've kind of got it in our heads today that, you know, we should get paid for the things that we love doing. If you're lucky, you can find an overlap, but ultimately you're getting paid for delivering value to others.
Yeah, that's another example of a reframe where it wasn't that long ago that we didn't have these choices and these options. And so, like, someone's like, if you can find a slither of it, just be grateful every day that you get paid to pick up a camera and go out and shoot people because you love doing that.
Yeah, and it may not be the perfect thing it might not be the exact thing you wish you were photographing, but hey, it's like there's good overlap.
Yeah, 100%. Just going back to this idea of the visionary, I've heard Tony Robbins talk about this concept that there are like three types of people that run a business. There's the kind of like the artist, the creative, the person who just loves doing the work. Then there's like the manager who loves people and systems and processes. And then there's the true entrepreneur who's sort of really just focused on these big ideas. They love taking risks. What's the next big thing? What's your take on that?
Well, I think the visionary comes out to play in different ways. That like someone who's a people person, when they're in visionary mode, they spot the opportunities to bring teams together, and then they understand how to motivate those teams, and they understand how to have powerful conversations that kind of elevate, you know, the team into action. Someone who might be a product innovator, when they're in visionary, they see product innovations and they can, like, you know, spot ways to improve the product. So I think our creativity comes out to play in different ways, and we all have a different zone of genius when it comes to our creativity. And I think too, all of those people can go reptile mode and destroy stuff. So someone who's great with people and knows lots of people, if they're in reptile mode, maybe they piss everyone off. There's the classic executive roles within a company. So there's the CEO who's kind of like the visionary for the company. And then there's the CMO who's making sales and generating leads, and the COO who's running a tight ship, and the CFO who's keeping score and making sure the company doesn't run out of money, CTO who's like building out the technology. There's those classic executive roles, and then there's the teams that are associated with those roles. So I think we each kind of can like build up towards one of those roles that is a natural strength.
Okay. So what I'm hearing actually there is that when you talk about visionary, you're not talking about it in the same way as like the visionary of the company. It's like we all have our own visionary within us, and it sounds more like it's related to flow. Like, when are you in flow? When are you in your
flow, zone of genius? Yep. Exactly. Yep. Elevated states. Yeah, exactly. You've got perspective. Yeah.
Okay. And when you think about creativity personally, how does that relate to entrepreneurship for you?
For me, I feel like creativity is linked to getting things into the marketplace. So it's like, you know, launching something, getting something out to market, taking something to market, shipping it, getting it out there. You know, I hear people say, oh, you know, my problem is I'm too creative. And I'm like, doesn't seem to stick for me. If I created a cake, there should be a cake there that's finished that I can have a piece. It doesn't mean that I'm imaginative. Like, I think people have like confused being imaginative with being creative. Like, I think creativity is much more linked to productivity, that it's like you're producing something of value, you're creating something, you're bringing something into the world. And in business, it's like you're bringing something to market. So someone who is highly creative is putting a lot of things out there in the market that the market wants and responds to. So it's like a prolific filmmaker is making lots of films that are finished and out there, and a highly creative songwriter is finishing songs, recording songs, putting songs out there. You can listen to them on Spotify. It's that ability to get stuff done and finished and in the marketplace and being received as value, not the early stages of imagination.
I think that's a hugely important distinction, especially for people running a business. I know things that people have told me in the past is the fear that stops them putting their work out there is the fear of being judged or it not being good enough. And I could probably go on. Have you ever experienced those thoughts and fears?
I feel like they're almost a given. Like to me, it's just like, of course it's going to be judged. And of course, a bunch of people won't like it. That's just a given. You know, my wife hates the Beatles. I know I just mentioned the Beatles before, but she just doesn't like the Beatles. It's like they're the greatest band of, you know, history. Like, they literally, you know, everything that's in modern music, the Beatles did a version of it earlier. You know, like, you know, how can you not like the Beatles? She doesn't like the Beatles. There are plenty of people who don't want an iPhone. You know, it's like, how do you not want an iPhone? Of course an iPhone's the best phone. It's like, no, I hate iPhones. Okay, fair enough. You know, there are plenty of people who walk into a store and like just don't buy anything. They looked at all the products on the shelf. Like, we've all done it. We've all walked into a retail store and like looked around and sort of seen all the products and not bought anything. It's like you just judged all the products and decided you didn't want any.
And so what's your internal narrative like when you're creating things and putting things out in the market? How do you think about that that allows you to be okay with people judging, people not liking?
I'm just interested in how many people actually do buy it. What's my target? So for example, with Score App, you know, I want to get it up to say 20,000 subscribers. that's all I'm really focused on. Really not too focused on how many people aren't subscribed. It's like, okay, great. I got 7 billion people not subscribed at the moment. So that sucks. But, you know, I'm more focused on, okay, like how many subscribers do I need this month? And I'm just going to focus on getting that number of subscribers. Occasionally someone cancels their subscription and they write like in the comments as to why they, you know, cancel it. And they're like, you know, this product sucked or something like that, or I didn't like it. It's like, you know, especially with a comment like that, you know, it might be a bit cross. And be like, you know, screw you. That's but if someone says, I didn't like it because I wanted it to do X, Y, and Z and it didn't, it's like, okay, should we develop that? Should we not develop that? I wonder if anyone else is thinking that. So then it's just curiosity. Curiosity. I wonder if that's a significant reason why people aren't buying, or if that's a significant concern for more people.
Let's talk a little bit more about testing, because I think that's a segue also into something I want to talk about around Score App and other things that you're developing. But if I'm a creative and I'm like, I hear you, Daniel, okay, but I put a post out the other day, or I spent so long on this showreel and I put it out on LinkedIn and it got 2 likes, what's the point?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah. How do I keep up motivation to keep on going and keep creating and keep delivering value to the world?
Well, you're not, well, for starters, you're not delivering value to the world. you've posted something that only 2 people cared about.
Okay.
So you're not paying enough close attention to what value looks like. So you might enjoy that, but clearly you're not creating value to the world. How do you stay motivated? Because you need to eat. You need to pay your bills. So yeah, maybe you shouldn't be motivated for certain things. Yeah, maybe the market's telling you that that's not actually of much value, right? It sucks.
Yeah. And that's such an important point. Like, how do I deal with that as somebody who's so attached to their craft and what they love doing?
Give me an example.
So I'm a designer, but actually my passion is really animation. And I've studied, I really wanted to get into it. So I bought this course, spent all this money, and I really just love animating things. But I've talked to my clients about animation and none of them seem to care. They all just want design.
Yeah. So, well, there's a couple of ways. You can either respond to what they want and do design, and then you use some of your spare time to animate stuff because you enjoy animating stuff. Or you start paying attention to who might get benefit from animation. You know, animation is a skill, right? So here's the thing. There's a supply side of what you do and there's a demand side of what you do. And the skill of delivering something is like an input. So if we think about like a chef who's cooking, you know, there are ingredients that go in, but in most cases, people are not worried about all the ingredients. They're worried about how the meal tastes at the end. And they're worried about whether that sounded like a good thing to order on the menu. Like, for example, let's say you're doing animation and you talk to a private school and you ask, you know, what do you care about? Like, what is it that makes you tick? What is the numbers that matters most to you? And they're like, oh, we need enrollments. So we need people to be enrolled in the school. It's like, okay, great. So they don't care about animation. What they care about is enrollments. So like the only thing that's going to matter is, does this animation get more enrollments? So if you could show that an animation is really easy to highlight and showcase the value of the school, and that the animated approach is a much better, more viral way for people to share, and that it can be done in different languages, and that it's a little bit more universal as to who it appeals to, and that it's got more longevity, that it's actually going to last for longer and it's going to work for longer. It's like, okay, cool. So this asset that we can create, this is going to help you to get more enrollments. And here's the 5 ways that it gets you more enrollments for longer, for cheaper, for better. It's better, faster, and cheaper than what you're currently doing for getting the thing that you want. We have to link to what people want. Like, imagine a truck, and the truck is like, you know, going down the highway at top speed, and there's nothing you can do to slow the truck down, but you can attach things to the truck. You can put things in the trailer of the truck, and then it will tow the trailer. So think about what you do as that trailer, and that you have to link it to the truck, and the truck is what they want, right? So it's like everyone you talk to wants something, and it's not the inputs, it's the output. Right? That's what they want. You have to then find a way to link that trailer to that truck. So every client is like saying, I'm measured on my ability to generate leads, or I'm measured on my ability to make sales, or I'm measured on my ability to put our prices up. I'm measured on our, you know, ability to add valuation to the company. So it's like, okay, well, how do I explain this? How do I make sure that my skill relates to the thing that they want? And then that unlocks a lot. Yeah, I find a lot of people who've got that skill, they just talk about that skill as though it's its own thing.
Yeah, it's such a common mistake that I see. It's like every single creative agency, all they talk about is their creative work. Like, and then they wonder why they've got followers who are just other creative people like admiring this creative work and they've got no customers. It's like nowhere on your website or on your LinkedIn are you talking about the people that you help and how you help them and why they should even care about the thing that you're creating. Yeah.
Yeah. Like imagine someone walks into a bakery, you know, and they want to get a really nice birthday cake for their daughter for her birthday. And they're what they're worried about is like, is it a nice looking cake? Does it photograph well? Does it have a great icing? Can we put the name on the cake? They're thinking about that birthday cake moment. And you're just like rambling on about eggs. You're like, you know, we put eggs into this cake and we get really great eggs. And, you know, we're really big about figuring out like all the different ways to whisk the egg. And you're just talking about something that they don't care about. And it's like, okay, that's great. Can I get my daughter's name written on the top of the cake? It's like, yeah, you can. But have I told you about how many eggs we put in? It's like, I really don't care about the eggs and how many eggs. So you got to figure out what is it the customer actually care about? And then maybe they don't care at all about the ingredients. They're just interested in that. And maybe you say to someone, look, I've got a hunch that there's a way of doing this that will get you exactly what you want. And I'm willing to back that hunch. Can we bring together something, you know, and it's like, by the way, it's going to be some animation, but, you know, it's the animation, but the reason that we're going to do the animation is because it's going to be able to easily go into 10 different languages and we're going to be able to widen your market massively.
Yeah, 100%. Just before we wrap up, I want to talk about Score App. And the reason I want to talk about Score App is because earlier we said sales and creatives want to avoid sales. And now we're talking about finding client problems and creatives just seem to have this incredible resistance to just having conversations with people. It's like the weirdest enigma, the weirdest thing. And the reason I push Score App to all of my clients is because it's one of the easiest ways that I've ever found. It's like a cheat code for finding out these pain points and problems and frustrations and desires and all of the things that we need to find out. Can you just tell us a little bit more about, let's just stick with the example of the animation. So if I was going to go and find out what people want, how could I use something like Score App to do that in a way which means I don't have to go and have loads of uncomfortable sales meetings with people?
Yeah, so a Score App is like an online assessment where people answer 10 to 50 questions and then it gives them an overall score and then you discuss that score and then you come up with solutions on how to improve that score. So for example, you might have a scorecard called Do You Have a Powerful Brand? And it might talk about the brand image and it might talk about consistency. It might talk about having brand ambassadors. It might talk about having a brand philosophy. So it asks all these questions and it might say, are all the different marketing materials, you know, do they feature the same colors, fonts, brand? Do you have a brand guidelines? Have you trained your frontline team on how to, you know, on the brand and what the brand represents? Do you tell the story of how the brand got started and have you got a formalized way of telling that story? So you're asking all these questions and then people are saying yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. At the end, let's say out of a score of potential of 100%, let's say they score 28%. That person is highly motivated to improve that score. They do not want to be 28%. They want to be 88%, 90%. So they're sitting there going, okay, what did I score low on and how do I improve that? It's like, okay, we need that. We need this. We need a way of explaining the brand to lots of people. Okay, what if we did an animated video that explains the history of the brand and we can in 3 minutes get that story across? Oh, that would massively improve our score. What if we created a brand guidelines? What if we kind of like refreshed the brand? So now you're actually talking to people about how to improve their score and get a powerful brand. So what they want is a powerful brand that gets cut through. They answered a series of questions. Each question was either a yes or no and gave them an overall score as to, you know, the thing that they want. And then it highlights the gap. And, you know, it's kind of a bit like if you went to a fitness trainer and you said, oh, you know, I really want to get fit. And they said, okay, let's just take some measurements. And it's like, let's look at your body mass index and let's look at your, you know, percentage of body fat. And let's look at how much you can lift. Let's see how many times how long you can hang from a bar. And suddenly you go, oh, wow, 15 seconds, man, you know, I really sucked. And you go, wow, I can only bench press the bar and, you know, I need to improve. So the more you do these measurements, the more you realize, oh, wow, I'm significantly underperforming where I could be. And then it's very easy to sign up to a fitness trainer or a fitness program.
Yeah, so it does some of that hard work for you at the beginning. And one of the questions I always hear when I suggest people go and start more conversations is how? How do I start conversations with people? What do I say? Where do I find these people? And the thing I love about Score App is you can give away something valuable. So I know you did this with your book originally, and so I've just totally copied you and done that. But every lead magnet that we put out, we literally just ask people 5 questions. So every time somebody downloads a lead magnet, instead of us just getting a name and email like we used to get, we actually get information about them. And our questions are things like, are you running your business full time? What's your current revenue? These sort of questions that people just answer, and they just give us that information willingly. Yeah. Like if you reached out to somebody on LinkedIn, you're like, hey, Dan, nice to meet you. I'm just curious. Are you running your business full time? Where's your revenue at? They would be like, who is this guy? So that's like one of the things that I love about Score App is that it doesn't even have to be a full scorecard. It can literally just be a series of questions, and then you've got enough data on your, you know, animation page or whatever metaphor we want to go with to say whether people are actually struggling with this thing or not. And then it just makes that conversation so much easier because you can just send an email and say, hey, Dan, I noticed that you downloaded our, you know, animation guide or whatever earlier. And
Score App will even write that email for you.
Yeah. And Score App will even write the email with AI, right? So yeah, I just wanted to talk about that because I think it's a really underrated and undervalued way to have more data about people, but also to be able to just start conversations easily.
Yeah, exactly.
And what I find interesting is you've probably experienced this, right? It's like you go and give a talk and it's so easy to go and have a conversation with a keynote speaker because they've just told you all these stories and about themselves and their company. So you've got all of this information about them, but it's so difficult to start a conversation with a stranger because you don't know what question to ask first. You've got no data from them.
That's a great point.
Yeah, it's like a cheat code, right? It's like you're getting data about somebody that they might not have revealed to you in a conversation, but it's okay because they just kind of click some buttons and they're like, well, it's the internet. I'm just going to do this thing.
We built a really big business off the back of just one scorecard called the Key Person of Influence Scorecard, which is measuring people's personal brand. And I think 90,000 people filled it in, and, you know, we ended up passing those leads onto the sales team, and tens of millions of sales came in off the back of it. It was just really that conversation starter, 40 questions, answer these 40 questions and it'll tell you whether you're building a personal brand. People loved it. Like people loved filling that in and they loved talking about their results. So yeah, scoreapp.com. You can set one of these up very easily on scoreapp.com. The other thing too is a lot of people want Score Apps set up for them. So a lot of agencies are actually doing this as a product for their clients as well. They're building a Score App for their clients.
Yeah, 100%. Highly recommend it. We use it for our business. We push it towards all of our clients because it's such a powerful tool. Literally, you can build a landing page. Even with AI, it will build it all for you. But as you're a creative listening to this, I'm sure you want to do it yourself. But literally, I built one the other day in less than 25 minutes and it looked great.
Wow.
So we'll put a link to that in the show notes. We'll also put a link to your book, Key Person of Influence, in the show notes. You've written a lot and I never know which one to recommend because it always depends where people are on their entrepreneurial journey. But I know Key Person of Influence is one of the most popular books that you've written and people can grab a free copy of that, right? And they can also experience what it's like to fill in a scorecard and get their influence score.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Awesome. Daniel, thank you so much. I know you are highly in demand these days after your big podcast appearances. So I appreciate your time. Where can people find out more about you? Where can people connect with you? Where do you hang out online?
Yeah. So at the moment, I hang out a lot on LinkedIn. I never thought I'd say that, but actually LinkedIn is my number one spot at the moment. I'm on Twitter, I'm on Instagram, but LinkedIn, yeah. So just at Daniel Priestley on LinkedIn, and also the books on Amazon. So, you know, you can see my author page on Amazon. You see all the different books I've written.
Yeah.
And by the way, I do also want to mention, I actually came onto this podcast with a cracking headache. I'm usually a little bit more upbeat. I've been a little dark on this one.
I think we're good. I like it. I like one thing that I wanted to make sure we got on this podcast was something a bit different. I didn't want people hearing the exact same thing as other podcasts. And I think we very much got that. So I've enjoyed it. Thank you so much for pushing through and answering my questions, even though you've got a banging headache. And yeah, I hope to see you again in person sometime soon.
Nice one. Cheers, Matt.
Before you leave, if you found this episode valuable, please hit the subscribe button. Also, if you are a creative business owner doing more than 10K a month and you want to grow and scale without working longer hours or hiring a massive team, then I have something you may be interested in. We have just developed a tool that will give you a custom growth strategy based on exactly where you are in your business right now. So you can stop consuming lots of random content and trying to figure things out on your own and actually get something personalized to you. You will also receive a free copy of my book, and it will point out relevant chapters. If you'd like to take the scorecard, it's totally free. You just have to click the link in the show notes or connect with me on LinkedIn, and you will see a link in my bio. Thanks for listening. This is the Creative Courage Podcast.